You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nathan Labins, host of the Cognitive Revolution podcast, a highly regarded podcast about AI. I'm a regular listener. You're also founder of Waymark, which is a company that I guess I'd say helps mainly small companies with a limited ad budget make video ads, and it harnesses AI to do that in some kind of interesting ways. I actually went to the site and went through a tutorial. It's kind of shockingly simple in principle. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that. One thing we're definitely going to talk about is artificial intelligence. That's for sure. How powerful you think it's going to get, what risks you think it poses, maybe what should be done about it. I wanted to start out talking about the open source question, whether powerful open source AI models are dangerous, if not like the current generation, maybe the next generation. That's been in the news for a couple of reasons. One is it figures in the question of whether OpenAI betrayed its founding mission, a question that has been raised by Elon Musk's lawsuit. I think there may be some misunderstandings about the extent to which open source per se explicitly figured in the founding mission of OpenAI, but we'll get into that. Also, this State Department commissioned report, not to be confused with the State Department issued report, just came out this week, recommending that the government seriously consider banning open source AI. And for people who don't know, open source is what is the path being pursued by Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, Google, and OpenAI, and Anthropic are not open source now. That's part of the controversy about OpenAI. And so we're going to start off with this, get into allied related issues, and just expand the parts unknown. Does all that sound okay?
Sounds great.
Anything you want to amend that I said that was wrong about you or anything else?
No, that's me. I mean, I describe myself these days as an AI scout, and I kind of perform that role for Waymark, which, as you mentioned, is the company that I founded, and also just try to perform it through the podcast and, you know, everywhere else that I am active, basically as a public service. You know, I think that obviously the AI moment is happening very quickly. And my expectation is that for better and likely for worse in different ways, and we could talk about that, I do think it is going to be a transformative technology. So the gap that I see and that I'm trying to fill is just trying to understand this phenomenon from as many different perspectives as I can, and hopefully have, you know, a very holistic worldview to share.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation because I found you to be, you know, an open-minded kind of analyst of the whole issue. You're not kind of fervently on either side of the argument. You certainly are concerned about the risks. And also because, you know, you're in the business and you have, for whatever reason, I think developed a reasonably deep understanding of like what's going on, to the extent that anybody has an understanding of what's going on inside LLMs. I think you can help us along a number of dimensions. So first of all, tell me, like, I think of open source, and like most things, it's probably not that clear cut exactly what qualifies as open source. I've heard people say that Meta isn't full on open source. Maybe you can comment on that. But I think of open source as being basically you give them the code basically and say, here's what makes it run. In the case of these large language models, that consists most importantly of giving them all the so-called weights, that is like the value of the, like, I guess, billions of parameters in a given LLM. And that pretty much, you know, allows them to do what you would do if you were Meta, in principle, at least. That's the way I think of it. First of all, it of course started with this, well, it first became famous with this, you know, Linux and so on. And it's this community spirited thing. And that was a case where there really was, I think, no profit motive. Now, Meta's up to something else. I don't think Mark Zuckerberg has no profit motive. But first of all, what would you add to what I've said about what open source is?
Yeah, it is different in the context of AI as opposed to traditional software. Traditional software, you know, it really amounts to the source code. Back in the day, you know, we would have, and I shouldn't even say we, because I wasn't really involved in software too much in this era, but you would have sort of the source code, which is the code as the developers typed it, and also as they would, you know, future developers would need to read it to be able to edit it. And then you'd often have the compiled software into, you know, binary format that would be distributed. So a lot of times when people back in the day were buying software, they would be getting a version of the software that they could install, they could run, but they couldn't necessarily actually look at the code that made that software, you know, come to life, right? So
it's kind of like giving you editing privileges in a document or something.
Yeah, so open source is you could actually read the code and you could also modify the code. And, you know, then we, of course, have like community-driven development programs, you know, with all sorts of different projects. In AI, you have that same layer as well. But I would say there's probably, I would put it in maybe four different layers of open source. One would be publishing your methods. That is, you know, here's kind of roughly what we did and roughly how we did it. A lot of times, even in academic work, you know, where they are publishing the methods, the details, though, can be a little bit fuzzy, right? Because people are writing in sort of sentences, things can be lost in translation. So you still have that next layer, which is the code. And, you know, the code is how to, you know, set things up, how to actually run it. But you do need, as you mentioned, the weights. The weights are the trained model. That is the thing that has actually learned. The code itself is usually a pretty simple wrapper around that thing that is actually learned. More of the complexity, the information, the actual value is embodied in the model, which is made up of the weights. And then where people are currently, I would say, debating most of all with like the metas of the world is, and this is different, you know, for open source, this component didn't exist in the earlier version of open source, the data. What data was it trained on? And their meta, to my knowledge, has not been open source in that they just are not telling the world, you know, what the data set is that
are trained on. If you have the weights for purposes of reconstructing the model, you don't need the source data, right?
You can run the model without the source data. You can certainly use the model, you know, for all sorts of tasks, right? I mean, in these general purpose chatbots, what kind of makes them interesting really in the most fundamental sense is that they can kind of handle anything, right? You can throw anything at them. So if you have the weights of the Llama 2 that Meta put out there, yes, you can run it with the code and throw any task at it that you want to throw at it. You know, it'll be better at some than others, of course. I think where the data mostly comes in is research. Researchers really want to know, what was it trained on? What does it know? Did it learn certain things effectively? You know, then you could even get more open source with like checkpoints. So this is something we've seen a couple projects do. I think most recently the Allen Institute put out a language model where they also released the weights as snapshotted at all these different points in training. And so again, that's mostly a research thing. Like your typical user that's building an app is going to use the last weights because those are presumably, you know, the most trained and the most capable. But if you want to know, well, what is the path of learning that this thing took? You know, it was there a curriculum? Curriculum learning is a pretty significant trend in how models are trained. It's pretty well established at this point, for example, that learning to code helps with other kinds of reasoning tasks. It seems pretty clear that like learning to code intensively, relatively early in training is good.
There's been a ton of research about curriculum learning means focusing on a specific thing like programming in the case of code, or like the LSAT, or like
You can design a lot of different curriculums.
Domain specific.
I would say it is domain specific. Although there are probably going to be, you know, best practices that will become common across the frontier foundation models over time.
Can I ask you on the issue of just being transparent about what the training data was? It seems to me that it would be an obviously good thing. Leave open source aside, because that's not that tightly connected to open source per se. It just seems to me it would be a better world if everyone had to disclose that in the first place. What's their excuse for not doing that? I mean, OpenAI is a good example. Okay, fine, you had to adapt and to the current world, and you can maybe justify certain of the seeming departures from your founding mission. Again, it's not so clear that open source per se was even part of that, but my question for OpenAI is like, what's your excuse for not being transparent about the data? I mean, if you trained on my data, don't I deserve to know that? And who doesn't deserve to know? What would their answer be? Is there a good answer to that?
I think you could, depending on, you know, what's a good answer will obviously be in the eye of the beholder. If you were to take, first of all, leaving aside like a purely pro-social mission or a nonprofit mission, leaving that aside for a second, just, you know,
which apparently like OpenAI, apparently OpenAI has left aside, but we digress. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think they would necessarily agree to that in quite as stated, but just starting with a purely business focus for a second, I do think there is at the frontier definitely a mix of data that was kind of grabbed off the internet and is just kind of the public pool of data, but then also a very significant investment in high quality data that is, you know, as much of a critical ingredient to their overall success in creating GPT-4 and whatever's coming next, as are the techniques, you know, that they use to, you know, all, as is the source code, right? Like it really takes both. People typically say the three parts of the formula to make AI work are data, compute, and algorithms. And, you know, you have a ton of data out there publicly, but they have, I don't know the nature of their investments, but certainly safe to say they've put many millions of dollars into hiring very high-end people, increasingly like PhDs, to both create examples and to evaluate what the language models are doing.
Okay, so just to be clear, there's this, after training, there's this thing called reinforcement learning through human feedback, where, you know, people, they ask it a question, it gives an answer, and they go, no, I don't like that for one reason or another, depending on what their guidelines are, or that's great, or it's kind of great. And then the model learns further through that. But what you're talking about is kind of prior to that. It's not that per se, this use of experts to instill particular things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's throughout the process. There is a lot of effort put into just the quality of the data. I think, you know, the emerging general wisdom is quality matters even more than quantity. You got to have both, but quality is really, really key. So they have done a lot to, you know, filter that giant mass of public data, and they've got a whole data licensing team that is partnering, you know, with different data owners and striking private deals to bring new data in.
Could this include people like combing through a Reddit thread and saying, no, this part is stupid and this isn't? Like, we want them to train on intelligent comments, not stupid ones? Or what's a specific example of what this is? Because I'm not clear on, like, is it literally proprietary data of OpenAI's because they created to have new text created, or is it more like some human filtering on a fine grained level what qualifies as training text, or what?
I would guess it's both. I don't have any real insider information there, but I would guess that they are aggressively filtering the broad public pool of data to try to refine its quality. Essentially, almost think of it as kind of like, people say data is the new oil, but, you know, I'm not a big analogy person, but there is a refinement process to this as well, right? You pull the raw crude out of the ground, you can't put it right in your car. You don't really want to train your frontier LLM on the raw internet either, right? So there is a refinement process. I think that process largely is probably automated at this point. I don't think you have individual people going through Reddit threads and classifying them. Like GPT-4 can do that pretty well. So where the humans are really working these days is probably at the high end, you know, of, hey, is this graduate exam problem in physics properly solved here or not, right? That stuff gets pretty hard to evaluate in a lot of cases. And you need people that, you know, are like genuine experts in the field. But it's really all of the above, I think. I think they're applying language models at scale to filter data, all the way up to, you know, PhD and even professor level expertise.
Well, I would settle for them showing us the crude oil, so to speak, to show us what the pre-refined and filtered text, like, did you use the journal Foreign Affairs? Did you use any left-wing journals, which I might like, on foreign relations? And so on, you know, these are important things as AI becomes more powerful in shaping our worldviews. And also, did you, you know, use any data? You really probably should have paid copyright fees for something. But do you?
I don't disagree with you, by the way. I do think like, to expect a little bit more of the frontier developers.
Yeah.
I think that's something that, you know, society is going to probably need to do on a bunch of little margins over the next couple of years. I think, you know, it is, this technology is so powerful and, you know, so likely to be transformative in my mind that I don't really think the narrow business interest lens is the final word at all. You know, to say, well, okay, that's the argument, right? We put all this into it. We own it. You know, it's our secret sauce, whatever. In a normal business context, normal technology, I would say, okay, that's the rules of our, you know, society. I do think like this is a rule bending, paradigm shifting technology. So for society to come say, hey, we're going to put special demands or expectations or requirements on you. I do think that's like very reasonable, very much in bounds. And the devil is very much in the details. I don't think, you know, I don't think it would be a great idea to say you have to open source all your data. Both because I think that probably wouldn't be fair from a business standpoint, and because we might find that, like,
by open source, you just mean be transparent about the data, not.
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly what level of transparency. Yeah, okay. Also, you could provide aggregate statistics, but you could also provide the actual, you know, raw files, right, of all the text and all the images, sure, and everything that's.
But
going
none
into
of
it.
That is tantamount to releasing the weights, which is what people really worry about. All the risk concerns about OpenAI have to do with like giving them the weights and giving them the innards of the model, right? I mean, text aside, you know, we could all in principle, yeah. Let's move to the OpenAI question. And at that point, you can, it looks like you were about to kind of correct me or diverge from what I said, and you can start by doing that. But I'd like to look at the question of the extent to which OpenAI ever actually promised this open source. I had Reid Hoffman on the podcast. He was one of the initial funders. He said they didn't. And I think, you know, I looked at their kind of announcement blog post by, I think, Sam Altman and Greg Brockman, maybe, didn't mention open source. Now, Altman was, around that time, in interviews using the term. So he can't complain about people having the wrong impression. But I haven't found anything in OpenAI's own self-description about open source per se. So do you want to tell me if what your take is on that, and if they didn't promise that, what they did promise?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I have a, you know, comprehensive historian's view of what they did or didn't promise at different points in time. It seems like there were some mixed signals sent, right? I mean, certainly the word open is in the name, so we start with that. Then there, you know, there have been things that were open source. So whether they said it or not, they did set some precedent that they were open sourcing things. And you see kind of in their internal documents, some of which have come out this week, that, you know, Chief Scientist Ilio was sort of saying, well, the open is for, you know, open access, open benefit, but not necessarily open, you know, on all the details. So it seems like that, and that was, you know, whatever, 7 years ago or something, I think. So that seems to have been something that they were definitely thinking about for a long time. I guess I would say my take now is, you know, a lot of the smartest people that I know have pretty radical uncertainty on the biggest and most important questions. And in that context, it's really important to stay open-minded and be willing to change course when needed. So of all the things that I think we might want to, you know, criticize or demand better from the frontier model developers, I actually don't think that inconsistency is really a major dunk on them, actually, because they, like us, are figuring this stuff out very much as they're going. They don't really know what trajectory the technology will take or what, you know, benefits or downside risks it may have. And so I think, you know, of course you could accuse them of cynicism. There's a lot of different ways to analyze this question, but I don't think we should expect that people will be perfectly consistent, because we are all encountering surprises along the way, and adjusting to that, I think, is really important. So my sense actually is, most of the time, and I did study this pretty closely, a bit of backstory on me is I was a part of the GPT-4 red team.
That's right. There's a whole story there. Maybe we'll have time to get into about There was actually, as I recall, a certain amount of tension between you and OpenAI as things went on. But the point is, before any of us had heard of, I think, any GPT, before GPT-3 was public, I think you were on the red team for GPT-4, which I guess is some kind of honor. They didn't call me. And to find kind of, you know, try to jailbreak it and do various things, make it misbehave and so on. So go ahead and say what you're going to say about that.
Yeah, so GPT-3 did exist at that time, but ChatGPT had not been released.
That's what I meant. We hadn't.
The public broadly was not yet paying attention. Yeah. I was a customer of OpenAI already and had established, you know, a little bit of a reputation, I think, internally for just providing useful feedback on the product. Certainly not alone in that respect, but that was enough to get into this kind of early access preview program. And yeah, there was a bit of tension because it was a major leap. And I was like, wow, this is incredibly powerful relative to anything else the public has seen. And I was concerned that their safety review didn't seem to be a super big project at the time. And I really didn't know what else was going on. And they're, you know, very secretive about what all they had going on. So over time, I've gotten a lot more comfortable as they've, you know, turned over more cards and just shown what their plan actually was. At that time, most of that plan was still not announced. Since then, a lot of it has been announced. So I was very nervous. I kind of like, you know, escalated some things internally there. I think I, you know, made a couple of people uncomfortable. They ultimately asked me to leave the program. And since then, they have definitely won a lot more trust from me anyway. I don't necessarily want to say that I think their work in safety and preparedness is adequate. If anything, I would say it's probably not, but it is clear that they're trying really hard. Anyway, though, all that is backdrop too. I have had this one window in time where I kind of knew what was coming. This was like a 6-month period from late 2022 until GPT-4 was launched in 2023, in March of 2023. And I had intensively used GPT-4. I knew very well what its capabilities were from this testing period. And then I had the opportunity to kind of watch what the OpenAI leadership team was saying in public while I knew, you know, a lot more than their audience knew. Mm-hmm. And I would basically say they seem pretty earnest to me in public. They're obviously speaking at a super simplified level. They're not trying to give too much away, but the very kind of high level qualitative guidance that they've given, I think, has been very consistent with what I knew to be true, you know, in that period where I had that insider view. So I'm pretty inclined also to take them at their word when they say that they genuinely are really worried about what open sourcing might mean long term, and that they want to approach it with caution, you know, with the public interest in mind. Mm-hmm. That does kind of happen to align to certain, you know, conceptions of business interest. So it's not something that you can fully pull apart or prove, but, you know, to the degree, and I've definitely spent more time on this than most, to the degree that I've had a chance to validate their statements, you know, against kind of privileged information, they have largely checked out. And I don't take a cynical view of their statements about their concerns about long-term safety.
Okay. And I mean, another thing, aside from open source per se, that you might have had reason to expect from them early on is that they would make all their research public, or maybe they would make all their patents free and so on. On that front, I mean, maybe you already covered this and I missed it, but on that, the openness of the research, Ilya Sutskever, even on that, leaving aside open source per se, that's 7 years ago in that same exchange you were citing, he said, you know, we will, as time goes on, it's going to be dangerous to let even that stuff out. And there was a note, if you wanted to be cynical, there was something that one of them said, maybe Elon even, but one of them said, of course, for the time being, it's helpful to recruit the best talent to, you know, to do certain things that we won't do forever. Okay, fine. I don't deny that it might. I mean, I should, you know, put my cards on the table. I don't know how dangerous this stuff is. I'm not a sci-fi doomer, Yudkowskyite style, but I don't foreclose that possibility. I'm just not one of his converts. I do believe there are other kinds of risks, you know, with bad actors, various things, including sheer level of social disturbance by the rapidity of the change. And for that reason, I'd love to see things just slow down, right? And give us more time to think. And so I'm not against deciding, even on kind of public spirited grounds. In other words, I can see you making the call on public spirited grounds that we're not going to release our research. Now, conveniently, that's good for your business model, fine. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I would say that. But my view is that's the kind of thing you had clearer reason to expect from them. That kind of transparency, research, maybe giving away patents, more than open source per se. But in any event, you think it's not impossible to justify their basic path in terms of public spiritedness, even if it does clearly dovetail in some respects with their corporate interests.
Yeah, I think it's a perfectly justifiable overall arc that they've taken. Mm-hmm. Not to say that it's clearly right, but I do think it's, you know, there are definitely credible arguments for, you know, the general direction. And I think one thing too that is important, right? They are at the frontier. So there's a big difference between open sourcing something immediately as it, you know, kind of comes out of the, you know, GPU cluster training infrastructure and, you know, is first being explored versus open sourcing sometime later when it's really well understood. So people will make fun of them, for example, for not open sourcing GPT-2 right away. They initially said, and this was February 14th. I remember it well because my first son was just about to be born and my wife was like getting checked into the hospital. I was just, you know, kind of nervously sitting there reading on my phone, and here's GPT-2 was announced on the day that we were at the hospital. So it hasn't been that long. I mean, he just turned 5. And at the time they said that they weren't going to open GPT-2 because of the risks. And now people look back and say, well, you know, how naive, like, you know, that's been out there. And of course it hasn't been a big deal, but that doesn't mean it was obvious at the time, right? They did identify risks that I think were at least worth taking seriously, like misinformation and just, you know, ubiquitous spam and, you know, whatever. And their attitude has always been that we are going to need time to adjust to this technology to kind of understand it and to build whatever, you know, defenses or kind of countermeasures or just, you know, just to reach kind of new equilibrium. So to give people some time to do that before just open sourcing everything, I do think is defensible. And then another aspect of it too, that's really important, is that first of all, the abilities of a model are not understood when it's first created. That is the characterization and the full mapping out of what AI systems can do is an ongoing process. We are still seeing a full year after GPT-4's public launch. We are still seeing advances in state-of-the-art performance from better prompting methods, better, you know, giving it access to databases where it can look stuff up, giving it access to programming tools where it can, you know, run a simulation or try something and see what works, you know, API calls that it can make, all of these sorts of things, the best practices for doing those have all been developed in public over the course of the last year. And I still don't think we're at the end of what GPT-4 can do, but we've certainly like got a much better understanding of it now than we did a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot more than it was a year ago, right? When you talk to ChatGPT or the, you know, the base language model and you say do X, what it can do in that initial, you know, that one-off generation of text is a lot less than what it can do when it's put in a loop, you know, in a computer. And that's basically mm-hmm. how agents, people may have heard the term of AI agents. An AI agent is basically a loop where the computer just keeps coming back to the LLM with an update on here's the situation, here's our goal, you know, now what do we do?
So its first cycle creates an effect on whatever it's interacting with in the internet, and then that determines what its next cycle will be.
Yeah,
that's why it could go find your plane reservation and then book your hotel and all that.
Yeah, and those things don't work super well today. I mean, I'm fascinated with them, and I think they will work, but we're definitely still in the process of kind of ironing out, you know, all the kinks in the agent systems. But yeah, there's a qualitative difference between, you know, kind of two sorts of qualitative notions of expansion from the time that the model is created to now. One is what it can do once we add all these things to it. And the other is like our conceptual understanding of what it can do, which was very rough in the beginning and is now, you know, increasingly pretty well mapped out. So at some point, can GPT-4 be open sourced? Probably. I think that is likely, you know, not going to be the end of the world. But it really wasn't it wasn't obvious at the beginning because we literally didn't know what it could do. So that has been kind of true since GPT-2. I think, you know, at every stage, it kind of becomes a bit of a higher stakes question. And so, yeah, I think there is definitely this sort of phased release. You know, I think what OpenAI might also say is like, look, we have told a lot about our methods, right? We've in all sorts of different ways, not the super low level technical, you know, code base implementation details, but like broadly, people do have a pretty good sense of, you know, how this is happening. And it's no accident that like Google is kind of converging on very similar products. So, you know, there is some shared knowledge of what's happening, and lots of stuff is getting open source, and people do have access to increasingly good things open source. And OpenAI definitely has contributed to that. A lot of people train on OpenAI's data. That's one thing that they do have terms of service that don't allow this technically, but they basically don't enforce it very much from what I've seen. So a lot of the models that people are using in their own applications are trained on data that was generated by OpenAI. So they are contributing in many ways to the sort of diffusion of the technology. And there's just, I think it's really important to understand that, you know, there's a lot of different ways for technology to diffuse. Giving people access to an API before giving them access to everything, you know, that is necessary to make that API. I think there is real wisdom in that kind of cautious and gradual thinking, given the, you know, just highly uncertain nature of how fast this technology will progress.
And I should say, I'm not necessarily in favor of rapid diffusion myself. And my whole position on open source is pretty unformed. The one thing I'm sure of is there should be a lot more discussion of it quickly, because if the argument against is valid in its strong form, the government really needs to get involved. And ultimately, that's going to require international regulation for it to hold. And we need to start the process. I think that is the basic dynamic that was embraced in this report commissioned by the State Department, was you develop a national regulatory regime and then try to make it go global. That makes sense in principle, whatever the regime is. But why don't we get into so basic pros and cons of open source? I think of it as an argument, the pro-open source argument being largely about preventing the undue concentration of power. And I do think you should worry about a world in which two or three corporations are building these models that I think are going to be deeply influential in lots of ways, and possibly will increasingly shape individual human beings' decisions and paths through life. I don't think that's crazy at all, and could shape our politics and our political decisions. So the big part of the case for open source is, if everybody can play the game, then these few big corporations like Google and OpenAI will have competition. That'll be healthy. The argument against is, these things are super powerful, and if you just put them out there and let everyone, first of all, including bad actors. I mean, first of all, there's the sheerly accelerationist effect that I might worry about, because I am a go slow and think about it guy. But then there is the bad actors thing that they can do things with true open source that are harder for them to do. By like jailbreaking a closed source model. I think there was an actual study that found it's easier to jailbreak open source than closed. It just seems obvious that it's going to be easier for more people, good and bad, to start trying to do, and in some cases succeeding in doing, more different things, and some of those will be bad. Would you say, I've kind of summed up the basic argument, what would you add on either side?
Yeah, I think that those are the key high level points that people worry about the most. And maybe I'll just try to, you know, figure out, okay, so what? Now where do we go from here, right? So just to summarize, concentration of power is a real issue. A friend named Andrew Critch has coined this term, the big tech singularity, which he defines as the point at which, you know, these sort of leading 3 to 5 to 7 big tech companies can effectively enter into and begin to dominate any industry that they choose to dominate, mm-hmm. because they have, you know, the general purpose AI and maybe the robotics and kind of whatever to just be like, okay, we're going to, you know, we're going to crush this industry. So that's, I think that is not unrealistic, actually, that the big tech companies, you know, are just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger because they are the ones that are building these frontier capabilities.
So the comparison to the generic singularity is just kind of point of no return, right? With generic singularity, it's like acceleration reaches a point where it's got its own impetus. And this is similar. He's saying there's some point of concentration of power among several things where it's too late to try to change the trajectory.
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily too late, you know, from a total societal or governmental perspective, but it is conceivable. You know, I don't think we've ever had companies in the past, and I don't think we necessarily still have companies quite yet that could just enter into and win in any market. But I do think it's not hard to imagine your Microsofts and your, you know, Alphabet, Google's getting there, because first of all, they have the cash balance to just buy, you know, decabillion companies in whatever industry they want. And they have the frontier AI capability to mm-hmm. deploy to, you know, radically streamline operations, you know, in kind of the most mundane lens. Or what you see out of DeepMind all the time are these super specialist models that, you know, come up with drug candidates and material right. science, you know, advanced candidates.
They also both have platforms, and I think Google especially, and I think this is sometimes underrated. You know, I mean, Google has, well, they have search, they have maps, they have Gmail, they have Docs, they have Android, they have voice assistant on Android. These are all places where you've already got a big audience and you can just deploy the AI. Microsoft, I think, has significant but less significant platforms. And the other company I think of in that regard, I guess, is mainly Apple, but they don't seem to be doing much. But anyway, these companies have the ingredients to become super dominant.
And they have Amazon, you know, definitely should be in there, probably arguably Meta. I mean, they don't necessarily have quite the frontier research of the others, but they do have global networks of data centers, which seems to be shaping up to be one of the forms, you know, the key forms of deployed capital that would enable, you know, what you'd think like, well, why would they be able to do this? Well, first they could just buy, you know, your pharma company of choice or whatever, and then, you know, bring these frontier models and the scaled compute. And the hypothesis is, you know, before too long, you kind of focus your AI lasers on whatever problem, and it's probably going to, you know, have the winning solutions. So I do think that, you know, this fall under concentration of power. I think that is a very real concern. I'm not necessarily one who says we should like break them all up. I think keep in mind, right? Like if they've ready to cure all the diseases, like we all win from that, right? So I'm not, if you were to say, hey, concentration of power, but they cure all diseases, well, I'd be willing to tolerate some concentration of power, you know, to have all my diseases cured by a big tech company if that's kind of the
or correctly diagnosed or correctly diagnosed at a low cost, which is already, I think, kind of here. I mean, you know, but.
Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So yes, okay. Concentration of power is the risk that we, you know, the concern on what happens if, you know, these top few companies run away with the competition. Bad actors is broadly even weirder scenarios, but bad actors is pretty down the fairway and pretty obvious on the concerns about open source. Certainly already, you know, you have things like North Korea running open source models to run their, you know, phishing scams and all that kind of crap, right? I mean, that's out there for sure. I'm honestly surprised it's not already a little bit stronger and more pervasive than it is. One good comment I've heard about that is if you're in today's world, if you're able to use AI tools that effectively, there's plenty of gainful employment for you. So like not the intersection of people who are capable enough and sort of, you know, in a position where it would still make sense for them to like run phishing scams is a pretty small overlap at the moment. And you know, so that's where like North Korea, you know, and Russia comes in, you're excluded from the global economy. You can't participate in the normal right. gameful way, but you have those skills. So you turn to these sorts of dark corners.
Can I say, I think this is the one place, where a Cold War environment, like with respect to China in particular, could actually just politically exert an inhibiting effect on the pace of AI progress rather than the opposite. I mean, in general, it's going to be an arms race dynamic. People are going to be saying, we have to develop our AIs because, you know, China is, and it's a battle for the earth and so on. But with open source, and I guess you were saying you're surprised you haven't heard this more in particular, or, I mean, I'm surprised I haven't heard more people saying ban open source to thwart China. Otherwise, they will use our best open source models to compete with us or something, right?
I think that point of view is definitely out there. I don't really subscribe to that because I think there's plenty of strength in the Chinese research ecosystem at this point that they're not going to be super far behind us in understanding. I didn't go to the most recent NeurIPS conference, which is a giant, you know, machine learning AI conference, but a friend of mine did. And he said the number of people speaking Mandarin at the NeurIPS conference was like a very significant percentage. And you could just look, you know, I read a ton of AI literature every single day. You know, at this point, it's like hundreds of papers per day published. The number of Chinese names on all these papers is, again, a very significant percentage. That. And the number of papers that have only Chinese names is a very significant percentage.
Yeah.
So now that's not necessarily out of Chinese institutions all the time.
Right. Although there are a lot of papers out of these, Chinese, you know, institutions too. Many of them are Chinese Americans and so on, but China has its own impetus for sure. And, you know, Baidu and the big tech companies. And of course the Biden administration is trying to make hardware the big bottleneck with the chip restrictions. I don't know how long that's going to work, but anyway, go ahead wherever you were headed.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I find that AI kind of scrambles all binaries and always kind of demands some synthesis of these opposing views. So, you know, maybe I can attempt one. If we're worried about concentration of power on the one hand, but we're also worried about abuse on the other hand, and then you get this call for, like, you know, banning open source, is there a way to kind of square all those? I think that the power of the system is really one of the key questions, and not all these systems are created equal. I don't really know too well, but I've listened to a podcast called Last Week in AI. One of the hosts, Jeremy Harris, is one of the founders of that company, Gladstone, that did the report for the government.
Oh, I hadn't made that connection. And that's funny because that's a national security company. That's the way he describes it on the podcast. Okay, I'll have to put two and two together and ponder this for a while, but go ahead. So yeah, Gladstone did this report for the State Department. Speaking of this, there's another podcast I listened to called AI Update. Not AI Breakdown. So it's a daily NLW. Podcast. Right.
Yeah, I'm a fan of that.
And
as well.
I will say on this issue, he said something that I thought was a little naive. I mean, he's not a slowdown guy. I don't know if he's in accelerations, but he was kind of trying to minimize the importance of the report. He said, what really happened is these like private sector guys at Gladstone, they kind of, you know, networked with the State Department and finally got to a point where they found the right unit in the State Department that dealt with nonproliferation and got it to commission this report. And that's what really happened. And I just thought, are you very familiar with American politics? There's always a backstory about interest groups. I mean, there aren't, you know, it's like, this is how the sausage is made. But the fact remains that this, the unit within the State Department, whose whole purpose is to think about proliferation issues, chose this company to do the report. I think it deserves some attention. But anyway, that you're mentioning the one podcast led me to segue to the other.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are both great resources for keeping up with AI. What I do tends to be more deep dive really into the weeds. How does it work? You know, AI content broadly ages poorly. So even, you know, I find our stuff, you know, is often superseded by events before too long. These other two are much more newsy and kind of the minute, but I do find a lot of value in both of them. So anyway, Jeremy, who's one of the hosts of the Last Week in AI podcast and one of the founders of this company, Gladstone, that did the report, you know, he's a sophisticated thinker. I think, you know, I can't speak on his behalf, and I haven't even read the full report yet because it just came out in the last, you know, couple of days. But I can say from having listened to, you know, dozens of hours of him on his podcast that he is a sophisticated thinker, that the ban on open source, I would bet anything, has a lot of nuance to be unpacked in exactly how they're recommending that would be implemented.
They just said the government should, maybe the phrase was urgently consider something. They didn't say it should definitely be done, but go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's one level of nuance, but also there would be nuance at the question of what would be banned, what would be, you know, sort of mandated review before it could be released, and what would just be something that you could just straight up release, right? I mean, we're not putting the genie back in the bottle, so to speak, right? All these open source models that are out there are not something that can be pulled back. Jeremy, Gladstone, they all understand that. So they're not saying that there should be no open source. Almost certainly, and again, I haven't read this exactly, but I'll bet confidently that they're thinking in something along these lines. It's at what point does something become big enough, you know, enough compute, enough data, enough billions of parameters that it starts to reach into that category of, we really don't know what this makes possible, right?
Yeah, well, they're not saying take Llama 2 off the market, but they must be saying there is some generation beyond which open source would be, well, might be, they're saying, consider this, too bad an idea to allow, which would be a serious disruption in face of Meta's business plan, among other things. But
yeah, you know, I'll speculate that I think Meta might just reach that conclusion on their own at some point as well. They have the benefit from a release standpoint of trailing. So they were able to look at a year's worth of ChatGPT, maybe not quite a year, but whatever, 6 to 8 months, whatever the exact timing was, and say, okay, this is all that we've seen. Like, these are all these jailbreaks, blah, 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 blah. Now, can we put a ChatGPT free tier? You know, that is GPT 3.5. That is not GPT 4, right? There still is no Llama that's on the level of a GPT 4 or a Claude 3. Llama 2 is not there. Llama 2 is at the level of a GPT 3.5. Which is the free version for OpenAI. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So they had the benefit of looking at tens of millions of people using it and, you know, probably tens of billions of chats and just seeing what the impact was. And then they could sort of say, okay, we now can feel reasonably confident open sourcing this. If they were on the true frontier where they were the ones creating models that we literally did not understand what they were capable of, I'm not so confident that Zuckerberg would want to take on that risk. Either for his business reasons, you know, he might not want to get sued. He might not want to get hauled back in front of Congress. And he also might genuinely at some point think, you know, hey, this maybe actually is irresponsible. I think it's just the relative position of the players.
Well, he might also think now that I'm the one with the secret formula. I mean, if they were truly ahead, right?
Yeah, that very well could be too.
Yeah. So to your corporate interest, if you are at or exceeding state of the art at your rivals, it's not so obviously in your interest to open source anyway.
Yeah. Now he has said, to be clear on what he has recently said, he has said that they plan to build AGI in an open source way. But I do, you know, so that's what he said. But I still kind of do suspect that there will be some back off or some qualifying of that. And, you know, what they, in the term of art for the API access before and maybe at the exclusion of open release is structured access. The idea there being we want people to have access for multiple reasons, both because hopefully they're going to find value in it, but also because we're going to get a lot better window into what happens when people have broad access to this technology. That's kind of an OpenAI's argument. And I think anybody who's dealing with like capabilities that they themselves don't understand, if they're really trying to be responsible about deploying it, it's like, maybe we should kind of create some sandbox, right? Where this can play out a little bit before it's totally released, because you cannot claw it back. You know, it's like just like COVID is here forever. Llama 2 is here forever. You know, it's not, it may die out eventually, but you know, there is no way to take it off the market, even if you wanted to. Like, governments can't do that, right? You're not going to go search everybody's computers. I mean, it's literally impossible. So to have some caution at that stage to create a sandbox, even if your intention eventually is fully to open source, you know, that could very well be just a standard prudent sort of step. And so my guess is, going back to that report, you know, you really dig into all their recommendations. I don't know how far they've gone with these recommendations, but I would bet anything that there is a tiered approach. True frontier capabilities that are not well understood. I think Jeremy, from what I understand, probably does think that there should be a ban on immediate open sourcing of that. Uh-huh. Stuff that is really well characterized, that's no longer at the state of the art, you know, maybe there's a process, maybe there's a safety review, whatever. Stuff that's low end, you know, that's already kind of what's on par with what's out there, or that, you know, something that's small that can run on a phone, that you can run on your own computer, that can do autocomplete for you, you know, million private use cases. I'm guessing they have no interest in even trying to put a ban on that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else you would say about downside that I've kind of missed? I mean, with open source, I guess I think mainly about the accelerating effect, which I, again, worry about, and just the bad actors. Anything you want to add, either by way of fleshing out bad actor scenarios or talk about a category that I've just totally missed?
I think we hit the high points. I would just probably emphasize that it is a shifting landscape, and quite rapidly at that. You know, one big question I have right now is, when will the agents wake up, so to speak? Wake up is a little, you know, colorful. I don't mean to suggest necessarily they're going to be conscious or whatever, but there are all these programs out there or projects right now to create autonomous AI agents. And they don't really work because the core models that power them are just not quite powerful enough to like overcome all the issues that they get tripped up on. And so they end up getting tripped up, you know, more often than they end up succeeding. But there is definitely a phase change coming where that is not going to be the case anymore. And they are going to start to work. They're going to just succeed often enough that we're going to have lots of AI agents running around autonomously doing things. And so to have some, you know, kind of bottlenecks in that infrastructure where we could say, hey, how do we close things off if it's, you know, going weird and or going wrong in different ways? I do think that's smart, not because GPT-2 is going to, you know, hurt us, or even GPT-3, and probably not even GPT-4, but we are kind of climbing this exponential, and there have been lots of surprises so far. I certainly expect more surprises to come.
Okay. That's a good last word on that. So now we have reached the part of the program where we go into overtime. That is available only to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which, of course, we encourage everyone to become. It's Non-Zero at Substack. If you Google that, you can subscribe, or you can become an unpaid subscriber if you're not one of those. There's also a link in show notes in the podcast app. And once you're a paid subscriber, you can set up your own special feed that'll just always have these. Most of our conversations have these special segments when our guests are generous enough to stick around, which you've proven you are. Anything else you want to say? I do want to encourage people to go to, is it waymark.com?
If you want to try the video creation experience, it's waymark.com/AI.
And it's interesting because when I first, I was vaguely familiar. I was familiar with your description of what you do. You help companies create video ads. And when Sora came out, I thought, oh, this guy's toast. But when you look at the model, and of course you will ultimately probably want to integrate Sora-like technology. But of course, Sora has still got its issues. It's not ready for prime time. But the other thing is, I realized there's other ways you're using AI. That's the kind of surprising part to me, is that you just tell the thing the name of your company, and it goes out and does this research and starts coming up with like plausible ads, and you can edit them kind of. So that was interesting. I encourage people to check that out. Anything else you want to say about, and also your podcast, of course, Cognitive Revolution, anything else you want to say by way of clarifying anything you've said, or where else people can find you? What is your Twitter handle?
I'm LaBenz on Twitter, LaBENZ. And the Cognitive Revolution is,
by the way, cognitiverevolution.ai. Okay.
And I think with Waymark, it's a good example of the need to fit AI into structure. Mm-hmm. The value that we create, we do not create the frontier technology. Right? We are proudly displayed on the OpenAI website as a customer success story. Because we were an early adopter of their fine-tuning product line, and you know, made something cool with it, and that's you know, honestly, one of my best references these days is, hey, you can see my work on the OpenAI website. So, and obviously, the whole team's work, not just mine, of course. But the value that we add is really figuring out how to make this super practically useful. So what AI can do, and that's obviously changed a ton, right? We'd launched this thing like 2 years ago now. What AI could do at that point versus what it can do today, you know, huge difference. There was nothing anywhere close to a video generator that could create the quality of clip that we would actually want to use in our product until fairly recently. And Sora, you know, is starting to hit that threshold. But regardless, even of Sora, right, what it creates is still an input to something else, right? Mm-hmm. It creates a clip. That clip might be beautiful. It might be, you know, it might be fantastical. It might be almost impossible to create in any other way, right? Some of these things, you just, because of the freedom that you have and your ability to prompt it, like, it'd be really hard to create some of the things that Sora is able to create. So there's like huge possible value there. But the business interest that we occupy, as you said, you know, toward the beginning, is we help generally small and medium-sized businesses, some local, some online, whatever, create high-quality video advertisements. Mm-hmm. We partner with media companies to do that, actually. So our distribution is mostly through like cable companies or broadcast TV networks or what have you. One of the big constraints that they have is to run a campaign on a cable or a connected TV, a Hulu or an Amazon TV or whatever. They all have standard formats that you have to comply with. They sell 30-second commercials. They sell 15-second commercials also sometimes, but they do not sell 27-second commercials. They do not sell 38-second commercials. So just right along, you know, right from the beginning, like, it has to conform to time. It also has to conform to shape. There's a number of other standards that it has to conform to. And then if you're a small business, you know, you want to put something on, you know, on the screen that actually communicates effectively. Sora doesn't even attempt to do that yet. I mean, not to say that it never will, right? But you can say, I want this magical clip of a drone flying through a, you know, Japanese city at night and it's raining and okay, well, it's amazing. It spits that right out. But that doesn't tell a story yet, right? That's kind of like the equivalent of a stock asset that needs to be now integrated into some broader project with some kind of, you know, overall strategy of what it is you're going to do. And that's the layer that we add. You know, we actually probably use, the numbers actually come down, which is interesting. At some point, it was 10 plus different models, or at least different AI calls, AI tasks within the sort of process of creating a video for somebody. That's trending downward because the models are getting more powerful. They can do more in one bite. Yeah. So we're, you know, actually seeing a gradual simplification in some ways of the system. But still, there's like, you know, 6 to 8 different elements of this overall process that an AI is doing for us, but it's designing that system, bringing it all together, you know, figuring out how to structure it so it works reliably, effectively, quickly, and then also giving the user control. So that's another thing with Sora that's a huge problem across all these generated asset products is like, if there's one thing you don't like about it, now what do you do? You know, you have a really hard time changing.
I wondered that because Sora, you know, people were rightly going wild, I thought. This is, of course, the OpenAI text-to-video generator. But I thought, okay, and people were talking right away about it replacing all of Hollywood. And I was thinking, okay, but how do you edit? Like, there's obviously going to be something you don't like about what it generates. And I'm sure it will get iterative, but it isn't clear that it is yet.
So, yeah. Well, Midjourney just launched a character consistency feature. And that's a huge step in that direction. We have a great creative team at Waymark that has really embraced making things with AI tools. They actually made a short film with DALL-E 2 about a year ago now. And one of the challenges they had at the time was you couldn't create consistent characters because every time it's just kind of, you know, spitting out something, right? So you want to have characters that obviously, you know, go on a character journey through your film. They have to look the same. How do you get it to do that? Well, they developed their own kind of prompting techniques that mostly worked and kind of didn't exactly have character consistency, but sort of fooled the user. And I have a whole deep dive on episode with them on how they accomplished that. And it's quite interesting. But now Midjourney just has character consistency. Now Sora doesn't yet have character consistency, and Midjourney is mostly image, right? So it is image. So it's not yet doing video clips. Will character consistency come to video clips? I bet it will, you know, and will text setting come to video clips? I'm sure it will too. As of now, text setting is also a big challenge for the image generators. The best of them are starting to do it pretty effectively, But for a long time, you could get like a stop sign that would say stop, because that's like an iconic, super, you know, common thing. But you want to put your own message on a birthday cake. A lot of times it just couldn't do that. Now that's starting to work. But what we have at Waymark also that is, you know, really, really valuable is an actual editor. So everything we make is structured. You know, when text is on screen, it's not text that is, you know, part, a native part of the asset, you know, that's at the pixel level where you can't do anything with it. It's an overlay. You know, we've broken it into this kind of structured form so that you can go and rewrite the text if you want to rewrite the text and have it say, you know, what you want to say and not have it be such an unwieldy process. So this is all in the weeds, of course, of like Waymark specifically, but generalizing from that, I think a lot of the work of making AI work for us is fitting it into all these contexts and figuring out like, what does the user really need? How can we get the AI to reliably do that? How can we give them the ability to, you know, verify? In our case, it's easy. They just watch the commercial, they like it or they don't like it, but also not just verify, but then also edit appropriately downstream. This is what's needed ultimately to have real value. You know, Sora is like a proof of concept demo. It is incredible, but it's an, you know, it makes things that are inputs to something else.
It's not a useful service in and of itself. And people should definitely check out Waymark. It doesn't take long at all to go through the basic version of the tutorial. So again, I encourage people to join us in overtime. That's where we're headed. And all you have to do is become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter. And thanks, whether you are going to follow us into overtime or not. Thanks for listening so far.